Welcome to The Created Life. The Created Life is a podcast featuring insightful conversations with people living life by their own rules and making a positive impact. I'm Damian Taggart, serial entrepreneur, wilderness guide, poet, and author, and I'll be your host on this journey. The Created Life is an episodic dose of inspiration, life hacks, and engaging ideas to help you grow and create a life you love. Hello and welcome back to The Created Life. First, I'd like to dedicate this episode to my dear friend Morgan, who passed away last week. Morgan brought a lot of joy to a lot of people and canine friends while she was here, and I want to honor her for that. Morgan, you'll be missed. For any of you who support the show this month, your contribution will be donated to the Taos Animal Shelter in Morgan's honor. I'm super excited about my guest today, a man of many talents, Theo Wilson. Theo is founder of Shop Talk Live, an organization that is facilitating live community discussions hosted in barbershops. And he is author of the book, The Law of Action, Master Key to the Universe We Actually Live In. Theo is a great role model, at least he has been for me, in terms of the way he deals with his own missteps as a man with respect to women and his candor and grace in discussing charged and sensitive topics like race, politics, and masculinity. But before we jump into the awesome interview with Theo, I just want to say a few words about the pandemic. It's been a little over a month since the last episode, and what a wild, challenging, and unusual time it has been. If your experience over the past 30 days has been anything like mine, you've probably gone through a host of emotions, and you may be dealing with a lot of financial and psychological challenges. As a parent, this time has had both positive and stressful aspects. I've taken the fact that my sons are home from school for the rest of the year as an opportunity to really step up my connection with them and try to redouble my efforts as a father. Having the boys out of school has definitely come at the expense of my own productivity and ability to get work done, which I'm sure that many parents out there can relate to. Many have also lost jobs or been furloughed or had to shutter their businesses and apply for emergency funding. I found myself at times dealing with feelings of rage and frustration that bubble up unexpectedly. And if you're also having feelings like this, I want you to know that you're not alone. Unfortunately, this issue, like most issues in our toxic political landscape, has been politicized and polarized, and our response to the virus in some ways represents a more tangible threat than the actual illness. This experience highlights some of the pathological aspects of our political organization and our culture's relationship to the natural world, to health, illness, and death. I guess what I'm trying to say is that if you find yourself sometimes at odds with the official response to this pandemic, you are not alone, and that you should not feel bad to express yourself about this. How we respond as a culture, as a globe, is far from a clear issue and deserves a careful examination on many levels, not simply from a medical standpoint. The way we respond to this raises important questions about many things: political, economic, psychological, spiritual, philosophical, and of course medical. That said, one thing is certain. We are all doing our best to respond to the threat of COVID-19 and protect our communities. We are learning a lot along the way. To better deal with the stress that arises from this unusual period of history, this is also a good time to double down on your self-care. Make sure you take the time to allow yourself to feel and process your emotions, but don't get stuck on them. I've been getting up early, about an hour before my kids do, so I can meditate and have a peaceful, quiet moment before starting each day in quarantine, and that has been a great help for me. Taking a hot bath in the evenings, going hiking, getting outside, throwing a ball with your kids, whatever works for you. Do what you need to do to process and take care of yourself. We are going to get through this. Well, I've rattled on enough. I hope you enjoy this episode. I think it's one of my best interviews yet. Here's Theo Wilson. Cool. Well, thanks so much for being here with me, Theo. I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the podcast. And I've gotten the chance to like look at some of your videos online and listen to some of your
nice,
very insightful words. And Also checked out some of your poetry, which was really cool.
Thank you, bro.
Yeah, man. So excited to talk to you. And one of the things that you said to me ahead of this interview, maybe jokingly, maybe seriously, was like, can we talk about something other than me? And so I actually wanted to say, you know, one of the things that I thought might be a cool way to start off our conversation is to kind of jump into sort of the end of your latest TED Talk, where you're talking about kind of bringing people together and sort of how do we start to see each other past the echo chamber that we're in, and thinking about kind of what is the end goal for like if we get people to be more aware and more connected, what does that start to look like? What does that open up for us? You know, so some of these thoughts might be a cool place to jump in.
Well, yeah, definitely. I appreciate you starting right there. So it's a power conversation. I run a nonprofit organization called Shop Talk Live, and where we just have community dialogues in barbershops. And we realized that there was a trust deficit in my community based on the fallout, I believe, from the crack era, the gang violence. There has been a downfall of what the elders used to know as the Black community. So we said we're going to meet the community where they at. So that's the barbershops. Brothers can come in, get their hair cut, and they talking anyway. So we organized a forum. And so that kind of ended up being an idea that I didn't realize had as much power as it did. So when we talk about the conversations that I was referring to in my TED Talk, we're talking about the conversations that bridge gaps and bring people together in a divided political climate, divided racial climate. And I've seen the power of conversations, which means I've seen the limit to the power of conversations. On one hand, power the conversations that we have the power to at least get each other to see one another as the human beings and not the conditioned reflexive responses that human beings give when they're triggered because of divisive subjects like politics, like race. So you're like, that's a person behind there who generally cares about the same things that I care about. They are afraid of the same things that I'm afraid of, and their conditioning has allowed them to take this stance publicly. And that's pissed me off, or that has not pissed me off. I found allegiance with that either way. Let's see if we can build bridges in that. Like I said, it has its merits and it has its limits. So, yeah.
Can you tell me more about like what you've been seeing at the like in these barbershop conversations? Mm-hmm. And like, what's the organization called again?
Shop Talk Live.
ShopTalkLive.org.
Thank you very much. Go and find us online.
Cool.
Yeah. So these conversations normally, and what we did, my organization took a stance early on to focus on specifically issues that impact the Black community. And the reason for that is because the umbrella minority doesn't necessarily encompass everybody. For example, the Latino community might not be as concerned about anti-Semitism as the Jewish community, right? Both are considered minorities. There are specific issues that African Americans have in this country that affect us more acutely than other people. And it felt like we were kind of shamed out of talking about the things that affect us specifically. With that said, the doors are open for everybody.
Sure.
You know, there's always an intersection where this specific topic crosses into the lives of people who may not fit the description that the conversation was designed for. So we talk about a lot of stuff, especially during the Black Lives Matter uptick during like 2014. There's a lot of talk about police violence. I've seen gang beefs squashed and resolved there. I've seen things that have to do with the way that our culture specifically treats our women. You know what I mean? And what that looks like when people who are historically oppressed also engage in a form of sexist oppression within their own community. Colorism, light skin versus dark skin. We've addressed all those things, but from the lens that this is how this directly affects us. And then whatever, if there's a news event that is like everybody talking about, it's like when Nipsey Hussle died, you know what I'm saying? It's like, we got to talk about what's going on in our community. So that's how we address these conversations.
That's great. So one of the things that you just brought up was like the idea that like even with a group that's historically oppressed, like Black men might have a hard time seeing themselves as oppressors to Black women or something like that. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more, expand on that idea a little bit?
Yeah, well, you know, the Me Too movement hit the hood, bro. You know what I'm saying? So there was a few brothers in the community that got in trouble because of their conduct towards women, including myself. Mm. You know what I'm saying? So I'm just going to put that like right out there. I am under no pretenses to be a perfect man. And so when that conversation came down the pike, I found out, number one, the hard way, my work wasn't done just because I had that conversation. And two, it was like, what are we going to do about the fact that when we try to create a unified front, a lot of the things that breaks down that unified front in our community are relationships. Whether this person slept with this person's being abusive toward this person, we formed allegiances here, we can't mess with y'all no more. Things of that nature often happen along gender lines. And so when the misogynoir, as they call it, misogynoir, the black misogynist, purports to be a community activist like I have done, and then also mistreats women, you're not going to get momentum behind your movement. And so that's how we address that. This was what's at stake. This is how we build that bridge. This is how we have to step up in terms of our treatment of women.
Totally. How have you dealt with and kind of combated that side of yourself, the kind of misogynist culture that you were kind of raised in? What have you had to do there?
Man, first you got to see it. You can't, your hands can't hit what your eyes can't see, as Muhammad Ali used to say. You know what I'm saying? So you got to first see it. And getting brothers to see it, it'd be a hard thing to do sometimes. You know what I mean? Because there's a very real war. Statistics bear it out all over the place against black male bodies. You know what I'm saying? Whether it be the war intra-community or what we call horizontal violence, or where it be that we are targeted for prison industrial complex or extrajudiciary assassinations at the hands of the police. There's something that's happening against us. That takes precedence now that, you know, but then like Sandra Bland died. You know what I'm saying? And the sister down there in Texas recently.
Right.
So it's like, all right, this is affecting all of us. We need to pay close attention to what it takes to become the people who our ancestors dreamed us to be. That's what I stay focused on. Hope that answered the question, because I sure forgot what it was.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of asking, like, what have you had to do to
personally,
kind of overcome?
Man, look, dude. Personally, I had to look at my own habits. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I had to look at my ugly black boy syndrome, bro. You know what I'm saying? There's been studies done to show that black men see themselves as less attractive. You know, even though, like, lately the world seems to disagree with that greatly. Like, lately the world be like, black men are hot. You know what I'm saying? And that's, right. Like, some new stuff. That's like the, like, you know, girl who was, like, skinny before summer coming back with curves after summer. It's like, dang, y'all on me now? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So what did that show up for me? What that showed up in, like, playeristic behavior. And then the fact that, like, I got really famous really fast.
Right.
Real famous real fast. So, you know, opportunities romantically that were not open to me before suddenly became open to me. And I was a kid in a candy store, right? And then I'm out here like, yeah, let's teach them well and let them lead the way. And it's like, bro, what's wrong with your behavior?
Right.
So that's how I had to do it. So it was a hard and is a difficult work of looking at my integrity. It all boils down to integrity. Like, if I say I'm with a woman, I can't be diving in every hot chick's DMs because she got something skimpy on Instagram.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? That took a lot of discipline. Mm-hmm. That was like weaning myself off of a drug, you know? Because the high of female attention is even more intense when you thought you was ugly and when you thought you were undesirable. You know what I'm saying? So I worked through the ugly black boy issue specifically within myself.
Got it. Yeah. Do you have any words of advice that you would give to, like, young men or young kids, like, in the world of, like, kind of, I don't know, just having gone through some of the experiences you've gone through, like, what would you say to, like, a 13-year-old boy who's just, like, getting into puberty and all that stuff?
I would say that be mindful of what your homies are telling you. A lot of us, when it comes to, like, toxic masculinity, for example, we'll just use this. A lot of us use other men as, like, our sounding boards and, like, moral compass. That ain't always the best, because a lot of us are dirt.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So, for example, I slipped into my behavior because at least I wasn't as bad as that guy over there.
Oh yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And I know that married dude who be cheating all the time. And this dude used to beat on his girl. I ain't doing none of that. You know, I ain't even married. I can just have me a little fun. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So there's the culture gives fertile ground for the justifications and rationalizations that we use to perpetuate bad behavior. And then, like, your homies don't check you. So I would first of all start with telling a 13-year-old young man, bro, watch the company you keep.
Right.
You know?
Totally. Yeah, and you just recently published a book. Is that right? Like, a couple years ago? Or?
Yep, The Law of Action, Master Key of the Universe We Actually Live In.
Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a... you were talking back to the idea of the law of attraction. Is that right?
Yeah. So when The Secret first came out, I went into the metaphysical bookstore around my way. And I swear to God, the lady at the front talk to me about The Secret like it was some brand new crack that hit the street. Hey, man, you got to try this out, man. You got to try it. Man, everybody on The Secret. You ain't know about The Secret? So I watched The Secret, and I started doing the stuff that they was telling me to do, and I was like, it's not working. And then on YouTube over time, there was these amendments and addendums and corrections from the people in the movie. Like, well, this isn't quite your wish is my command. It's a little more than that. And so I was like, where did the law of attraction come from? Well, it's a hermetic law, and they broke it. The law originally is act and ye shall attract.
Hmm.
A law of attraction is kicked started by your actions. So you could vision board all you want to for that new house. If you ain't saving, like if you ain't getting your credit right, that's not coming, bro.
Right.
Like, you know what I'm saying? I don't care how many times you play the lottery number. So it was this thing that says you have to do something to attract. Here's the thing. Action is not sexy. It's difficult. You know what I'm saying?
Totally.
And so people were sold on the idea that there was this hack to get in the thing that you wanted. And I'm like, nah, actually, when you take the action, you develop yourself spiritually so that you'll be ready for the thing that you're after when it arrives.
Totally. Mm-hmm. So yeah, tell me more about this like experience of kind of overnight celebrity. And I mean, basically you just went viral on the internet, right? Like some of your posts.
Bro, it was batshit. It was crazy. So can I cuss?
Yeah.
It was batshit crazy. So here's what happened. So my first taste of viral fame came in 2015 when I read this article by Ta-Nehisi Coates about the case for reparations. And it was a great article, but it was long as hell. I'm like, I'm about to shorten this up so the hood could understand. So the first, it's a 10-minute video. I didn't know that was like super long. And the first minute, I'm making the case against reparations as if I believe it, so that I could draw in the people who was like, yeah, well, they're not owed reparations. And I was like, but wait a minute. So the rest of the video, for the rest of the 9 minutes, I was just laying out in plain English and crediting Ta-Nehisi Coates for his research about, no, this is severely owed to us. And it got shared and it went crazy. I built an online platform. That's when I started getting trolled.
I see. Yeah.
And that's when I had the idea, the novel idea of, this echo chamber thing is interesting. Let me see if I could duplicate it.
Totally. And then you basically posed as an alt-right.
White supremacist, yeah. And Lucius 24. It was so, dude.
Yeah.
I do a lot of stuff, man. I'm an actor, singer, dancer, writer, slam poet. I didn't think that posing as an online Nazi would be the thing that broke me into CNN.
Totally.
It did. Right. And it was so simple. Like setting up another account doesn't take any time at all. So I didn't think that it was worth talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So how I got to talk about that was interesting because TEDx Mile High saw an interview I did with Westword where I talked about my online activism versus my in the streets activism. So they were like, well, write a script about that. And I had a very small portion about the undercover experiment. I wanted to talk about quantum computing. I thought it would be really cool if like a young black dude started talking about quantum computing. Mm-hmm. So I'd be like, oh, wow, young black dude talking about quantum computing. I submitted the script. And they were like, what the hell is this? What's this undercover crap that you did? I was like, oh, yeah, it's a stupid account. I just want to see echo chambers. But anyway, quantum computing. And they're like, no, bro, you got two scripts here. One is about quantum computing. One's about race in America. Which one do you know more about? And I was like, no fair. You know, it's what I know more about.
They were like, write what you know.
Write what you know.
Yeah.
And so I did the talk in July of 2017. And they released it the weekend of Charlottesville. And that was, that thing when you strap yourself into a roller coaster.
Yeah.
Because it got 1 million views the first day.
Holy shit.
And my inbox was blown up with CNN and PBS, NPR, MSNBC, all the letters. And I started to go forward with it. And, so that and then all the local news. So they published an article in the Washington Post. The Washington Post article got well over 1 million clicks. And they said even a good article gets about 500,000. So that got overwhelming. And so then after that, you know, local news, Channel 4, 7, 9, Fox, they all picked it up, did a story on me. So, yeah, it was a lot.
And so this going viral on this, right, really, like, helped kind of launch your career in a way?
Oh, yeah.
So before you got to that point, like, kind of what was your life like before that? And kind of what were some of the struggles you had, like, prior to that? Like,
I was working in the call center. I was working in a call center in Lone Tree, which is the computer that I did a lot of my experiment on. I had my activist life. My online life on my Facebook page was already kind of making me somewhat of a local celebrity, because I would get a lot of views on these videos, like some between 100,000 and 600,000 views. Wow. Oftentimes. Or just on my own, from my own Facebook page. My phone, then my online,
right,
then views. So that was kind of cool, but I wanted to be a full-time speaker. I knew, and they knew. Like, my supervisors knew, we're not going to keep him.
Yeah.
Something's going to happen where he's not going to stay with us for a while.
Right.
And that's just how it happened. You know, they ended up taking me away.
Cool.
Yeah.
And so these days you're basically a full-time, like, kind of inspirational speaker, motivational speaker, activist.
Yeah. I mean, full-time speaker and, you know, generally like a performer, because I'm also a singer, which is weird. Yeah, and I left my job in December of 2017, and I do it full time, and it is fulfilling, and it's relatively lucrative. So yeah.
Cool. Another thing that you brought up a couple times is like the experience of kind of like wanting to get inside the other side of the echo chamber. Mm-hmm. But then I think it was in your TED talk, you said something about how when you start to make decisions outside of the echo chamber that is your life, like, it's not just your online echo chamber with the algorithm on Facebook. It's like the echo chamber of the decisions you make every day and going through your routines and only connecting to the certain types of things that you feel comfortable with. Like, do you have any, like, or do you want to speak to how people can kind of start to break that up in their lives? What can people do to kind of break up that echo chamber and start to have some more conversations?
Well, yeah, if you're too comfortable, you got to understand you might be doing something wrong. And I've realized that, you know, birds of a feather post together. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, y'all friends, and then y'all algorithm have each other. And then so before you know it, and this was what shocked people about Donald Trump winning, was that it's like, how did this happen? Nothing on my online world reflected that this was a possibility if you were liberal. You know what I mean? So a lot of us don't like to get challenged on our perspectives. I figured that, number one, Shop Talk Live helped me step outside the comfort zone, because when I do a forum in the community, I like to do opposition research anyway. I like to see what all sides are, so that when I walk into the barbershop, nobody's going to catch me flat-footed.
Sure.
I'm the one who has to facilitate. I need to know what the hell I'm talking about. So I did that anyway. And that, so I was already somewhat kind of used to that tension. And I got a thick skin from being called a nigger all the time online, because it was like, all right, I've heard that. Okay. That's a 400-year-old word. All right, then. So, like, let's keep it pushing. You know what I mean? So, you know, and I had a range of reactions to that.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is, I knew that my comfort zone was a little bit dangerous, especially if I was trying to see the whole truth of something, because just nobody can see the whole truth of something.
Right.
We can do our best to approximate it, but I wanted to see why they thought they were right.
Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. So when you were doing that, what did you discover? Like, what did you, what did you learn about people who had really, like, different beliefs or different views?
Well, there's a sliding scale. There's conservative, and then there's horrifically racist, mm-hmm. right? Interestingly, they're on the same side of political aisle. We can talk about how it got that way. But what I noticed was that right-wingers and people who would call themselves conservative are trying to conserve something.
Mm-hmm.
What are they trying to conserve? Well, there's a button in human beings that likes the familiar. So if the conservatives are made up of predominantly white folks, and then you see all these brown people coming into the country, and then you see your president don't look like you no more, and then you feel like the world is changing too fast, just like they're trying to grab on to something that makes it feel like things will be the way that it was for them, for their children. That slips them into, because the idea of whiteness in this country is devoid of, like, heritage outside of this country. You know, if you were an immigrant from Germany, an immigrant from Poland, an immigrant from Ireland, or perhaps someplace that did not speak the English language,
right?
And you were considered white, I guess, in our eyes, you got beat out of talking that language.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no connection to your European roots. You just had to be this thing called white. That's your tribe now. But the problem with the tribe is that the motifs, the artifacts of that tribe are often a clan hood and a lynch rope when taken to their fullest extent.
Sure.
See what I'm saying? So when you try to cling to whiteness, even though that's a tribe that they say that you belong to, it ends up being you're clinging to the thing that made like oppression happen in the country. So people who are against oppression are now somehow against you, but this is your tribe. Like it's this thing that people don't really think all the way through.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? But they were trying to hold on to what they were seeing as familiar.
Totally. I love what you said. You made some reference to how nature doesn't care. You know, nature doesn't care about
these categories,
these qualities of race or whatever. It's like,
doesn't.
Nature prefers diversity. And I think that's a really cool idea. Do you see, relating that concept to like tribe, like how do you feel? Like what does the future look like for us? What do we want? What are we trying to get to? Like what are we hoping to do with the idea of tribe, with the idea of racial identity?
Well, most of tribe is formed often by outside forces. You know, people who would, for example, consider themselves black. That's a definition that was thrust upon us.
Mm-hmm.
Before I was black, I was Yoruba, Igbo, Akan, Hausa, Mende, Mandinka. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Then somebody's like, "Nah, y'all black, and y'all better get on this ship." You see what I'm saying? And so as a dividing line, then like people were made into white. The issue with that is that human beings, number one, let's just be honest, sexually are curious about different stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? Especially males. So that boundary was broken down just by the very force of sex alone, whether it was rape on the slave ship or just over time, you know, Jim Crow segregation. They didn't want black folks with their white girls because it's like she might find them attractive and then right. My grandkids will be brown.
Right.
And then everything will be lost. You see what I'm saying? And so what I think is happening in terms of tribe and as the definitions of race, we're not saying that there aren't any evolutionary differences between somebody who evolved in Sweden and somebody who evolved in the Sudan.
Yeah.
But the consequences that we attach to those differences are wasteful.
Right.
It's just wasteful. I sometimes wonder how many geniuses, doctors, possible inventors hung from southern trees. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's wasteful. And when we start to look at the effort that it takes to keep us separate, a lot of times it's just not going to be worth the fight. And I think naturally that will dissolve the tribe. And then you got ancestry DNA showing everybody mixed with everybody. And it's just like, okay, so how invested really are you on this box that you check on the census every year, every 10 years, you see?
Totally.
Yeah.
So how do we get people who are kind of stuck, or I guess we don't get people to do anything, but what is your sense of, how am I going to say this? Like, how do we get people who are maybe like stuck in a place of fear to learn that there's other ways to be, like learn that there's other ways to like think and see each other in different ways?
Well, first of all, you got to understand that the fear has been engineered in many ways. And the fear is a conditioning response. It is a conditioned response. Everybody knows that when you put kids of different races together in a sandbox, they'd be like, they can see the difference. Like, you're chocolate and I'm peach. You see what I'm saying? But after that, it's like, want to play with my truck?
Right.
You see what I mean? So knowing that they're afraid of loss. Most of these fears have to do with thinking that it's coming from a scarcity mentality, ultimately.
Totally.
And we've engineered scarcity very well on this abundant ass planet of ours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've gone out of our way to make sure that there's not enough for everybody.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? So what's interesting is I believe that a lot of what's going to get rid of the fear is when humans put their brains together and start engineering abundance again. You see what I'm saying?
Totally.
Like you got to actually put mechanisms behind dissolving these walls because mechanisms were put into creating them.
Mm-hmm.
It took 500 freaking years of imperialism to get it right here. And the Civil Rights Act of 1964 isn't necessarily going to change things overnight.
Totally.
You see what I'm saying? So how about a new economic system where the Earth's resources are distributed in a way that people don't feel so much fear about their tribe? We can do that. It's just we're blowing shit up right now.
You know? Yeah, absolutely, man. That's great. Yeah, so that's cool. I think that's really where my head's at too. Like the things that make me excited are just like thinking about what does the world look like when we get rid of having countries? When, you know, when can we like start to see each other as co-inhabitants of a world and, you know, start to rethink a lot. It's like so many of the things that we live with right now have not been questioned that much. Yeah. Or it's like we're just beginning to have enough consciousness to say, hey, do we need to have suburban sprawl? Like maybe there's better ways to organize ourselves. Maybe there's better ways to like share resources. Do we all need to own a lawnmower? Do we all need like, you know, all these things? And
why do you have lawns and not gardens? You should be growing some shit you could eat out there. You're just cutting grass every 2 weeks.
Like what would it take for us to actually want to tear down the walls between us and our neighbors? Like those are the kinds of questions that feel, you know, really future directed towards me, you know, for me.
Yeah. I mean, you got a book written by Sebastian Junger called Tribe. I think it's a very incredible book. And in the beginning of the book, he talks about how the problem that they had in the colonies in the early days of the United States was that white people kept running away toward the Indians. They kept leaving in droves. And Benjamin Franklin noted, but you never see the other way around. You never see like Native Americans after being introduced to like, you know, colonial Virginia. Like, yeah, this is where it's at. No, like literally the colonies were destabilized by this. And when, you know, people were asked, well, why you keep on leaving the colonies and, you know, going with, you know, the Iroquois Nation and whatnot, they was like, well, I find belonging there. And I find like relaxing of like certain, you know, religious mores there. Mm-hmm. And I find that everybody has a purpose there. It is a strange thing for a human being to be alone among thousands of people that they don't know. That's not supposed to happen.
Right.
Belonging is everything. Tribes are made more of belonging than they have to do with these cultural barriers. Don't believe me? Look at a sports team.
Sure.
See what I'm saying? There'll be people of all kind of colors on a sports team because they got a common goal. And everybody feels like they have a purpose, that their contribution matters. And they felt like that more among the Native Americans than they felt like that in the colonies. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
They find that suicide, depression raises along with standard of living. It goes up.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Isolation. And
isolation. That's what Sebastian Junger talked about. He said that more than anything, like, for example, he talked about World War II. One of the weird side effects of the bombing raids of like London was that the admission to the psych wards went down. You would think that these people would be traumatized from having bombs falling on them, and they kind of were. But when you gave people a goal and a mission and everybody felt like they needed to, you know, be the ones rebuilding, be the ones sewing clothes, be the ones growing food, then they all focused on being one people, one tribe, because they all had a mission.
Totally.
You see what I'm saying?
How much do you think about like being connected to others and being of service to others?
Man, I'll tell you this. As somebody who has struggled with depression, I can tell you that one of the fastest ways out of depression is to help somebody else and get out of your own damn mind. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't think humans are supposed to be self-serving like that. Like the way we've been told to self-serve. Like everybody like get rich or die trying.
Right.
Okay. And when you're rich, you get a goddamn castle and then you're by yourself. And then you're like, life sucks.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Totally.
Versus people who, like, they study people in supposedly, quote unquote, third world countries, and their happiness index is up like Kenya. Like, they went to places in Africa where people didn't have a lot materially. But when they had each other, they were like, I'm happy. You see what I'm saying?
Totally.
And, like, this is where I belong, and I know everybody around here, and everybody knows me. And I love everybody. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We are communal creatures who've been thrust into an industrial world. You know,
totally. Do you sort of see the like, are you tempted to sometimes look at the Industrial Revolution as a mistake?
Oh, man. Well, you know, as a descendant of the slaves who funded it. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I mean, all right. So technology is a funny thing because the very mechanisms that were built, most of our technological advancements normally come from war.
Mm.
You know what I mean? But ironically, we keep repurposing the mechanisms of war to connect ourselves. The internet was a network of computers so the military could talk to each other. Now you can find friends that you ain't seen in 30 years. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I think that it would be very difficult to nuclear bomb Nagasaki in Hiroshima if they could live tweet it and stream it.
Ooh.
See what I'm saying?
It's great.
Like it would be tough to do. Like if you could see charred bodies over there in real time and it goes viral. Right. See what I mean? So now those mechanisms that were meant to destroy other human beings are connecting human beings. And I think that that's where ultimately this is going. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if our entire nuclear arsenal were just directed towards space for asteroid defense. It wouldn't surprise me if that's what happened at some point in the future. Because people are getting sick of this shit totally. All over the world. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So, absolutely. Yeah. That's great, man. Yeah. So going back to the idea of just how divided the country seems, yeah. like...
Man, we can't keep this shit up, bro. Look, go ahead. I mean, cut you off.
No, yeah. I mean, I think like one of the things that's been really beneficial in my life, and actually I was speaking to my last podcast interview was with a guy who lives in Uganda. He's a Ugandan, really amazing dude. He was the only person in his village to ever go to university, and he recognized the power that he had. And it's a great, inspiring story. But one of the things that he said was that I asked him how he stays positive, even though there's so much like, you know, in Uganda right now, there's like so many things that are problematic for him. Like he's had essentially a dictator his entire life, one president since he was 1 year old. Yeah. And I was like, how do you stay positive? He said, one of the things that he does is he is really carefully controlled about what information he lets into his mind. So he's filtering out, like he's specifically not like listening to a lot of information because he knows it's just going to erode his psyche.
Yeah.
Because you've gone the other way though. You've kind of gone into.
Yeah, that wasn't a good idea in some levels. I'm going to tell you, like as a black dude, just immersing yourself in white supremacy for months.
Yeah.
Probably is going to have some unseen effects on my life. But what I could tell you is, so I used it for another spiritual practice, which was detachment.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying, like, I knew that I'd had to practice some serious non-attachment to sit and listen through a podcast from Jared Taylor, Stefan Molyneux, Vox, you name it, all of these guys who do not see the world the way that I do. Even some Ben Shapiro, you need to take a good shot of whiskey for. But what it was I needed to know that I could detach from my own perspective. And this was a great impetus to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So what's... People are very deeply attached to their perspective. People really believe the bullshit in their head.
Totally.
I couldn't believe the bullshit in my head because I was depressed all the time. Right. So if I kept believing it, I'd just die. You see what I'm saying? And mm-hmm. so I was like, okay, well, this is a reason to detach. Yeah. So I think that like it made me in some ways morbid. I also have a short fuse often like with aggressively bigoted people. I'm just going to be honest. Yeah. If somebody's misinformed, that's one thing. But if somebody's just being a dick, oh man, do I have a pot of wrath for those folks.
Right.
But what I think is interesting is mental diets, like your Ugandan brother was talking about, are necessary for mental health. Like if you go all the way in, you've got to have some time to detox. I think if we're more mindful about the fact that like the mind is like the body, you know, what you put into it is what constitutes it after some time. Well, then you realize that there is wisdom in selecting it, but also the body ingests like harmful bacteria just to keep the immune system tight sometimes.
Right.
So like you have to understand like you can't just wall yourself off and can't be like, no, don't bring me no bad news.
Yeah, yeah.
That's just a coming. It's called life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think that there's a balance between mental health and resilience.
Totally.
You have to develop both of them.
That's smart. Yeah. So that's what you were talking about when you said you kind of inoculated yourself with toxic ideas from the right. Yeah.
They were already trolling me.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew for a fact that if I continued to respond online, I'd get in trouble.
Right.
And I wasn't uprooting the problem.
Right.
I had to find the root of the problem. So that's why I did what I did.
Totally. So what does success mean for you right now?
Success?
Yeah.
Success looks like, number one, on the material level, providing long-term abundance for myself and those who come after me. Success also looks like affecting the kind of change that I want to see in terms of bridging those who have not with the things that they need. You see what I'm saying? I'm a fan of the underdog.
Yeah.
And when I see the underdog you know, what's being owed to them, then that feels like success to me.
Cool.
You know?
And who are your, like, most, or who do you look up to? Who are your teachers or mentors?
You know what? I'll be learning from everybody. Everybody, if you pay attention, got something cosmic to teach you. When it comes to, like, those who I seek out intentionally, that's everybody from the writings of John Henry Clark to Eckhart Tolle. I find a lot of inspiration in the writings of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. I find, you know, spiritual ideas. Like, I try to balance my political / worldly racial kind of diet with some spiritual stuff. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Specifically anything that has to do with cultivating intentional joy and peace from inside out.
That's cool.
Regardless of external circumstances. And anybody who can help me do that is definitely a teacher, even
That's
if they're
great.
Showing me what not to do.
For sure. Yeah, I love that. I definitely try to have that attitude of like, mm-hmm. I'm going to learn something from every person that I interact with, because it keeps you open and curious and respectful too. It keeps you like, you're not judging people as much. Yeah.
And you stay humble.
Totally. Cool. So what are you most proud of?
I'm most proud of? You know, that's a funny question. I don't really even think about that. I'm happy that I was at least at some point able to feel like I had a message that I successfully maneuvered out of obscurity. You know, I remember my life before like thousands of people had listened to me and now millions, you see. And that's like even weird to say, but it's true. You know, and so I know that there has been an arc that I pressed myself towards, and I'm proud of my ability to alchemize negative into positive.
That's awesome.
I've been able to do that a lot because there wasn't an alternative, really.
Right.
You know what I mean? Here's what you got. You're a black boy in America. You're in a neighborhood that has gang violence. Your dad's got PTSD from Vietnam. And, you know, your mom's making just enough to get by. And it's not obvious now, but I had a wicked stuttering problem.
Wow.
So now what do you make of this? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the fact that I was able to go from little Theo Wilson born in Park Hill to Theo Wilson that everybody's inviting to speak at their universities because of this weird way I'm able to bridge perspectives. I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
That shit took work, bro.
That's awesome.
You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, I would say at least that's where I'm at today, you know?
That's great. Yeah, that's really, really, really awesome. What does creativity mean to you?
Creativity just normally means combining things that wouldn't be combined and making something new. You know what I'm saying? Creativity, I think, comes with a responsibility, because I used to be a rapper and I used to say really horrible things. It was very creative.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I became a poet because I got tired of the negative things that I would create.
Yeah.
And I wanted to actually create things that would like shed light. Somebody said, great artists tell the truth. The best artists tell lies that tell the truth. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like when you can tell a fictional story that kicks ass more than a real story, that's creativity. You see what I'm saying? That motivates, impacts, and shows a deeper truth. You know what I mean? When you can create that out of yourself, I think that is the epitome of productive, wholesome, harmonious creativity.
That's awesome.
You know.
So I have a couple more questions for you. One is like, is there anything you want to talk about or kind of give a shout out to that you want people to kind of follow you or look at what you're up to? Look at your organization.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Shop Talk Live. We are continuing to work in the community, and find ways to heal the busted relationships that came from the trauma of our folks. So we're always looking for avenues to effectively do that. I think that, you know, certainly shout out to my book, The Law of Action. Pick that up. You know, it's not a fluffy spiritual book at all. It actually gets really into the nitty gritty. Like, I found the universal and spiritual purpose for violence. And I talk about that in the first chapter. and then, you know, go into what that means for humankind and the planet.
Cool.
Yeah, and I got a new TED Talk coming up on June 22nd.
Awesome.
Yeah, so, yeah, be looking for the new TED Talk.
Sweet. And so the one final question I have for you that I've been asking everybody I interview is kind of what would you, if you could implant one idea, one practice, and it would just spread to everyone on the planet virally, what would that be?
I think that it's important to view other people like they're just you in a reincarnation living parallel in time period. I think that, because that might be true.
Mm.
I think it most likely is. Like when you look at consciousness, if there was an all-powerful God, what would he do? Have fun. How would he do it? Like he'd be like, I'm going to forget I'm God and then totally use everybody else to remind me that I'm God. You know what I mean? And so that seems to be, and it's the basis for compassion. Like it's the basis for every good thing that you could do for somebody else.
That's great. That's basically like Ryan Fu and I were talking about that as you walked in the door almost. That's beautiful, man. I love that.
I'm glad I helped.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And I'll put some links to your stuff online. And good luck with everything you're up to. Thank you.
Thank you very much, man. Yeah. Appreciate your time, too.
That's it for this episode of The Created Life. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends about it or support us with a donation. Also, please let me know what you liked or didn't like about the show, and if you've got a suggestion for an interview or topic you would like TCL to cover, you can send a message to Damian@Wildest. That's Damian@WILD.IST. See you next time.